The following podcast is a presentation of the Washington College of Law at American University. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
Well, good morning, everyone, and welcome one and all to the third annual International Right to Know Day celebration here at the Washington College of Law, sponsored by the Washington College of Law's Collaboration on Government Secrecy, or CJS for short. This is an academic center that established here at the law school 2 years ago. And our first program of the eighth that we've already held was the first annual International Right to Know Day celebration, which was the first time that there had been an event in the United States recognizing that day. This is the seventh year of celebrating the National Right to Know Day on September 28th, just as we celebrate here in the United States Freedom of Information Day on March 16th, which everyone knows is the birthday of James Madison, considered the founding father of openness in government in this country. Well, the way this came about internationally was that in September of 2002, a group of open government advocates got together in Sofia, Bulgaria, and they decided that henceforth, that day, September 28th, would be celebrated as International Right to Know Day in the same way that the United States does that on March 16th. Fortunately, they paid no attention at the time to the Jewish calendar, and as it turns out, September 28th can sometimes be Yom Kippur, which is what it is, of course, today, which is why there are no classes here at the law school. The law school is closed for classes, so to speak, but it is open for events such as this. Now, that made it a little bit of a complication, because one of our speakers, Kevin Goldberg, wasn't sure exactly what he would do. Kevin raised that with me, but what we did immediately was we applied to the Vatican for a dispensation. And we've got two responses. It's kind of interesting. The first response was, gee, maybe you should be going somewhere else, I don't know, Jerusalem perhaps. But the second response was, oh yeah, we can give you one of those for the right price. That's sort of a Catholic joke, I suppose, and as a former Catholic, I'm entitled to make that joke, I think. So in any event, we're here today, and we're celebrating this. I just want to let you know the Collaboration on Government Secrecy has now matured to the point, and we're very happy about this, where we have at least four programs per year. And in addition to this annual one on this day, with respect to CGS's international work, we also do now serve as the principal location in the United States for celebrating Freedom of Information Day on March 16th. This past March, we have Senator Leahy here for that, and we will be holding our third FOIA Day celebration on March 16th, 2010. And then I'm very happy to say that we're going to be holding an academic conference that is very timely right now, I think, called the State of the State Secrets Privilege, right here on November 18th. Actually, it will be in the stadium seating auditorium just on the other side of the school, in which we're going to be gathering the leading scholars and practitioners who deal with the state secrets privilege to focus on exactly where that stands now this far into the Obama administration in relation to what was done with and to that privilege, shall we say, during the Bush administration. And we hope that some of you can be with us then, as well as our podcast and webcast audience. And then, last thing I want to mention is the program that we have after that, which is entitled Transparency in the Obama Administration - a First Year Assessment. And what better day to hold such a program than on January 20th, 2010, which is a Wednesday. And we're going to be gathering together representatives of the Obama administration, the public interest groups, so those who are interested in transparency in one respect or another. And we're going to be taking a good hard look at exactly how that first year has gone, ever since that day one issuance, so to speak, that stunned everyone and delighted so many people when President Obama spoke of doing business in the light of day and spoke very favorably about openness in government in multiple respects. And we truly do expect that that program on January 20th, 2010 will then be a first of a series of such programs that we have on January 20th, 2011, January 20th, 2012, which is a Friday, it's still a weekday, so we don't have a calendar problem there, in which we can take stock and assess the Obama administration's transparency movement, its activities, its efforts as time goes by. And in that regard, I'll also mention that CGS's website, which is now pretty darn extensive, even in its beta form, compiling a lot of academic information, now features something that we call the Obama Administration Secrecy Transparency Scorecard. And you might notice that the word secrecy precedes transparency there, and that's because thus far that is the primary thrust of where we stand. It really just does take time, and those of us who have been in government, especially those of us who have been involved in implementing policy, especially policy in this public policy area, transparency in government, knows that it takes a lot of time to move things forward. So we're hopeful that in time that will become known as the Obama Administration Transparency Secrecy Scorecard. But right now, even with the movement of the state secrets privilege with what was issued by the administration last Wednesday, which took the grade in that particular subcategory from a D minus to a B plus, right now you will see on the CGS website the overall grade for that is still a B minus. There is a long way to go in that respect. Now, speaking of the website, I also want to identify for those of you here and those of you in our home audiences, so to speak, that we have an extensive portion of it devoted to international transparency. And that's a handout that we have here for all of you. Matter of fact, some of you might not have received it at the very beginning because we were rushing to update that literally in the middle of the night. So the photocopying was done right about at 9:30 as we were arriving. But the first page of that shows our summary description, our listing, so to speak, our scorecard, I guess you could say, of the nations of the world that have a viable transparency regime. And I use the word regime there advisedly rather than the word law, because there is Argentina, which operates by way of presidential edict issued a few years ago now. So that's one instance in which it's not a statute or a law per se. And what we do, amongst other organizations that have attempted this in the past, is we try to very rigorously vet, I guess there's really no other word for it, the nations of the world that qualify for the designation. Now, I have seen, especially in the last year, some organizations, or in one case it's an individual in the Netherlands, who say, oh, we have 87 nations of the world that have such a regime. And I just saw a website just recently that claimed over 90. Well, I'm here to tell you that according to the Collaboration on Government Secrecy, which again focuses very carefully on exactly how things go in these nations, and also whether they are in fact a separate nation itself, which means that some, shall we say, entities don't make the list because they really are not distinct independent nations, we say that there are 79. So the website says more than 75, we list 79, which means we're almost at 80, which is quite extraordinary given that when I started working with the Freedom of Information Act, there were only three nations of the world, including the U.S. and Sweden and Finland, of course. And then 15 years later, many years later, there were still only three and then only six, and now things have exploded enormously. And they've exploded to the point of which the international word for what we call freedom of information here, transparency, has sort of migrated largely from Europe and South America to the United States, where now we talk about transparency almost in the way that we talk about homeland security. It's sort of the word du jour that is used to describe this area of the law and public policy. What we'll do today, as we've done in our previous International Right to Know program, is try to focus on big issues, big trend areas. And therefore, what we're going to have is attention on China. And we have the leading expert, I would say, on transparency in China in the United States, Professor Horsley from Yale Law School China Law Center. We're going to focus on the UK. We're going to focus on what's happening in the last year. And as part of our focus on the UK, we have Alistair Roberts here to give our keynote presentation. And he will tell you, and many of you might know, that this past year has been an extraordinary year for freedom of information in the United Kingdom, because it's a relatively young statute, only 4.5 years into implementation, literally almost overturned the government this past spring, when it, every the controversy there culminated in June over the disclosure of expenses of members of parliament. And I'm here to tell you, because I was there in June, and I saw how intense that was, it is not an overstatement to say that the government in the UK almost turned around based upon that controversy. So that's a big part of what's happened in the last year. What I'd like to do now is introduce Professor Roberts, Alistair Roberts, who is the Jerome L. Rappaport Professor of Law and Public Policy at Suffolk University Law School. And he is probably, and I don't think he would disagree with me, nor would anyone in the audience, probably the most prolific writer in this area, based upon not only articles that he's written as an academic, but also several books, including some award-winning books, including the book that might be very well known to this audience, Blacked Out, Government Secrecy in the Information Age, which covered this area very ably, so much so that it did win a National Book Award from the National Academy of Public Administration. And I'm happy to say that Alistair is a fellow, so to speak, in that we both hold honorary senior research fellowships at the University College London, where they focus more than any other academic institution on international transparency there. And he also is someone who has both a JD and a PhD, which is quite remarkable indeed. Let me just drop one footnote, as lawyers do and as academics do as well. When I mentioned the University College London, that's a center, so to speak, that is similar to what the Collaboration on Government Secrecy is, but it's not at a law school. CGS is the first academic center in this area of law and public policy at any law school in the world. And I'm pleased to say that now we have been followed, our footsteps have been followed, so to speak, by an academic center, and they spell it C-E-N-T-R-E, at the University of Dundee in Scotland, where they have just established this year something that is comparable to what CGS is in this country. So we have a strong tie, shall we speak, say, with the United Kingdom and Scotland, which has a separate, in many respects, transparency law. And that's why it's particularly good that we have Professor Roberts here to be able to talk about things that have been going on there in the transparency world. So, having gone on at that length, let me try to keep us on time as best as I can. And with that introduction, turn you over to Professor Roberts, who is going to talk about both events recently in the UK and other events from a very high-level academic perspective. So please help me. Professor Alistair Roberts.
Thank you. It's a treat to have the opportunity to speak with you today. I want you to know that I was not in any way involved in the decision to make September 28th International Right to Know Day, but oddly, it's also my birthday.
How does it feel to turn 40?
Yeah. At a certain point, you know, your birthday becomes just another reminder of the inexorable and unforgiving passage of time. So, given my experience with freedom of information, it seems wholly appropriate. But I'm going to talk about the UK today. But just to give you a bit of big context, the last 20 or 30 years have been really an extraordinary period of governmental restructuring around the world. And governments, policymakers have been buffeted by pressures for reform in in many different and often conflicting directions. But one of the big pressures has been for democratization, for empowerment of citizens. And that broad trend has been manifest in a bundle of different ways. Elections in countries that had never seen elections before. Decentralization of political power in heavily centralized countries, including the United Kingdom, to state and local governments. The introduction of participatory structures so that people can get involved in policy making. And also, of course, the diffusion of right to information or freedom of information laws. And Dan's noted the question of how many countries have them. We can agree at least on several, and several more than used to be the case only 15 or 20 years ago. And I think that over the last couple of years in particular, we have moved from a phase that was predominantly concerned with adoption of the laws, get a law on the books, into the implementation or digestion phase of how do you make the law work in practice? How do you realize its potential in practice? And the UK is a good example of that because it's now been in place for about 5 years. It will see its fifth anniversary on January 1, 2010. The law was actually passed almost 10 years ago in November 2000, but the British government, whose enthusiasm for FOI had begun to wane as the longer it was in his office, gave itself 5 years to put the thing into practice. So it came into force on January 1, 2005. And let me confess something to you. Dan said I was going to give you a sort of high-level approach to this. I'm actually come at this from two ways. As a scholar, I try to maintain a relatively impartial high-level approach to the subject, but I am also an individual who makes freedom of information requests. Very often, I'm making freedom of information requests in order to get information about the operation of Freedom of Information Acts. Not always, but most of the time. So I sort of see systems from both sides, or at least I try to. I see them from the top, and I see them from the bottom. And sometimes, you know, in a perfect world, the two views align. I'm going to confess to you today that in the British case, my experience from the bottom does not jive with my experience at the top, and I'm struggling to reconcile those two views. And what I propose today is just to be frank with you about the dissonance, and maybe you can help me sort it out. But with that in mind, let me just give you an illustration of my woes. 5 years ago, about this time, but September 2004, I decided I was going to make a request for information in the UK. I was working on a project that involved extracting data from something called Electronic Documents Management Systems, an innovation in government, basically computer databases that are designed to hold all significant documents in government bureaucracies. And I had done a couple of experiments. These things are just being rolled out. And I had done a couple of experiments in Canada and successfully, within a matter of months, obtained descriptive data about the documents held in these databases from the government agencies that maintain them. So who wrote a document, the date on which the document was created, the subject of the document, the security classification of the document. I was getting, in digital form, descriptive data about the documents, but not the document itself. And of course, these systems are designed so that metadata, as it's described, the descriptive data, the card catalog data, if you want to call it that, can be downloaded fairly quickly. Now, I knew that the UK was also in the forefront of adoption of these systems, and I knew that one department, the Department for Trade and Industry, or DTI, was in the forefront of adoption within the United Kingdom. So about 5 years ago, in September 2004, I started making requests for documents about their document management system under the administrative code that was then in force, called the Code on Access to Documents. Not a law, but a quasi-FOI arrangement. And I had a quite congenial conversation with the officials in the department, and they provided the documents. I learned about the capabilities of their systems, and I figured out what I wanted to ask for. So on January 1, 2005, the first day of implementation of the law, I filed a request for this data about documents held within DTI's electronic documents management system. And we had a good conversation about what I could or could not get. And I said, OK, I'll give up on some elements that were going to cause them trouble, you know, the title or subject of a document. We sort of agreed on a plan of release. And they released a significant amount of information in, I believe, March 2005. But one field we couldn't agree on was the author of the document, the name of the government official who had created the document. They took the view that that was withheld on privacy grounds. So we reached a sort of modus vivendi in which I obtained some of the data but said I will file a complaint to the information commissioner, the body responsible for dealing with complaints, and we'll let them figure out what the right answer is on the privacy question. I should say, too, that I obviously made a request, so I got some of the information and was denied on privacy grounds on the initial review. I did what is called an internal review, and I was denied on the internal review on privacy grounds. It went off to the information commissioner. And I would sort of periodically check in with the information commissioner. The complaint went to the commissioner in, I think, May 2005. And the commissioner began the investigation in June 2006 and said that this raises a valid and legitimate question, which we have to explore, about the application of the privacy exemption. And after that, as the years marched inexorably onward, I would check in every few months to ask how things were going, and I would be told, well, they're working on it, they're working on it, they're working on it. They're working on it. In May 2009, I did my now routinized, thank goodness for iCal, I can, you know, just put these trigger things on, how things going, and they said, well, we decided that last month. And I said, well, would it be possible to get a copy of the decision? And they said, conceded that was a reasonable request. They hunted around, and so I got the decision. Now, bear in mind, this is well over 3 years after I filed the complaint. And imagine my surprise at learning that they had ruled against me, but not on the privacy grounds. They had concluded that releasing that information would be prejudicial to public affairs, which is another exemption under the British Freedom of Information Law. And I was a little taken aback by this, because no one in the previous history of this request had ever told me that that application, that exemption, prejudice to public affairs was at issue.
Did they explain exactly what they meant by public affairs? It wasn't in the U.S. Senate or South Carolina governor's sense, was it?
No, it's a very broad, if I could reveal my prejudice, it's like a creative writing class for public servants. Mm-hmm. But the argument was that revealing that information would cause misdirected queries to public officials, I believe that was, and also encourage individuals in the bureaucracy to create documents so that they could appear productive when the information was eventually released. I should tell you that this case is, from my point of view, perverse. The commissioner ruled that neither of these arguments was sustained by the evidence. Neither of them was a plausible argument for withholding the information. But the commissioner then ruled that he could see no legitimate public purpose that would be served by releasing the information, and that therefore the information was properly withheld. And I objected that, just on due process, natural justice grounds, nobody had ever told me. Yeah, and I now know, because this case is before the tribunal at the moment. I now know that what had happened was that by about 2007, the department realized the privacy argument wasn't going to fly. So it switched arguments to a different exemption. And a policy decision was made by the department and the commissioner at that time not to tell me that the argument had been switched. So I was never given an opportunity to make representations regarding the application of that exemption. And I just told you that the key of the judgment is that there was no legitimate public purpose served by the disclosure of that information. I was never asked to explain what the purpose of that, what my purpose was in requesting the information. In 4 years, nobody ever asked me, neither the department nor the commissioner asked me why I wanted the information. The commissioner's position is that there's no statutory obligation to tell me when the department switches arguments, and no obligation to consult with me about the public interest that might be served by the disclosure of information. So that's gone off to the tribunal. The tribunal held its hearing on this on September 10th, and we're now waiting for the first round of the decision-making. If I'm successful in the first round, it will go back to the tribunal, where we'll have a de novo hearing on the question of whether the privacy application applies. I should tell you that DTI, the department that initially received this request, no longer exists. It's been reorganized three times since I filed the request. The official who handled the request is now gone. The investigator who handled the complaint in the commissioner's office is gone. The commissioner who decided the case is gone. The only party left who had any original interest in this is me. dealing with, I mean, we laugh, but I spent the summer drafting a legal brief to deal with lawyers from the commissioner's office and lawyers retained by the successor department. And it's been an incredibly wearing process and very, frankly, disturbing just based on the way in which it's been handled. I said when I began my brief in that case that I thought this was the longest investigation ever concluded by the Information Commissioner, and it turns out that I was off by 25 days. It's the third longest investigation ever handled by the Information Commissioner, and I'll tell you other tales of woe later on. But that's my bottom, from the bottom view of the way in which the system works. But let me give you the top level view. Just as a prefatory note, the UK ought to be an unqualified success story when we're talking about the implementation of FOI for a whole bundle of reasons. It's an established democracy. It's not unfamiliar with FOI. There was a debate about FOI in the UK for about 20 years before the adoption of the law. They had a rough version of FOI, this administrative code, in place for about 10 years before implementation of the new law. They've got a professional civil service, they've got good record keeping, they've got a good judiciary, they've got an active media, they've got active civil society organizations. So of all the countries that we're looking at that were engaged in the adoption of FOI laws in this period, when we look at implementation, the UK ought to be an unqualified success story. And so let me suggest that that's the bar we ought to be looking at when we're looking at the track record. Now, if you ask the Ministry of Justice, the ministry responsible for the adoption of FOI, they will tell you that their estimate is that in every year, roughly 100,000 requests go into all levels of government. The UK law covers central government and also local government and local government authorities as well. About 35 requests go to central government departments alone, like our federal government agencies. And that implies that in about the first 4 years, about 140,000 requests have been received just by central government alone. And that surely is far beyond failure. It's some kind of success. The Ministry of Justice would also tell you that of those requests, that is requests to central government, 80% were handled within the initial response, were handled within the 20-day deadline established by law. And they would also tell you that of those requests, 60% of resolvable requests were granted in full. So those may be measures of success as well. Roughly 5% of those initial decisions go to internal review. Only 1% go to the Information Commissioner. These are represented sometimes as measures of satisfaction. I think anyone who uses FOI knows that it might be a measure of satisfaction, it might be a measure of resignation, it might be a measure of exhaustion, it depends on the circumstances. But I think one theme I do want to emphasize, and you've probably already twigged on this, is that there's a danger in relying on aggregate data when you're looking at the operation of an FOI system. My sort of working proposition is that any FOI law, in fact, enables multiple systems, multiple different systems operating under the ambit of one law, but involving different kinds of requesters, looking for different kinds of information with different levels of sensitivity. And aggregate data can hide all of the important variations or modulations within one government. And that's something I want to come back to. But continuing in the good news brief, there are also many stories that illustrate the effect of the Freedom of Information Law. Morris Frankel, who's the head of the Campaign for Freedom of Information, has done a wonderful job of advocating for FOI and also telling stories about the way in which the law has impacted British political life. There have been waves of stories, as Morris says, about the operation of UK government information never before available to British citizens, about payments by public hospitals to settle negligence claims, about the distribution of agricultural subsidies to wealthy British farmers, including the royal household, about problems of recidivism by paroled convicts, about weaknesses in the oversight of nuclear facilities, about problems in the preparation of the dossier that justified the war with Iraq, about critical decisions that affected the sustainability of pension schemes, and most notably, as Dan has already referenced, this extraordinary case that stems from the release of data about the MPs' use and abuse of their expense privileges, a controversy which a request process that lasted for 4 years but eventually produced a controversy that has really had a devastating effect on public opinion about the entire political class in Britain. And incidentally, I think puts the lie to the notion that at least in the short term, FOI promotes trust in government. Pretty clearly have the obverse effect in the UK, and not without justification. Interesting, though, to make the point that all of these cases are high-profile cases, often pursued by journalists. We know about them because they are reported in the newspaper. There's a journalist, Jeremy Hayes of the BBC, who's just done a very interesting study about journalists' use of FOI, and he says that FOI has really changed the game for journalists. Again, though, we don't want to be misled just by what we see floating on the surface. In most cases, journalists don't count as the major users of the law. One estimate suggests that perhaps they're 1/7 of all requests to central government. And so we may be missing the other subterranean flows that are harder to detect. But the essential point, if we're looking at the aggregate data from the Ministry of Justice and the stories that we see in the newspaper reported by journalists, you would have to say that at some level, FOI in the UK works. It has changed the way in which politics works in the UK. Of course, the question would be, does it do what we had hoped it would do right at the square one? Does it work as well as we might have wished it to work? Another run at this has just been taken by the Constitution Unit, which is a research unit within the School of Public Policy at University College London. This is the unit that Dan and I are affiliated with, and the Constitution Unit is led by Professor Robert Hazel and his team of researchers, Ben Worthy and Mark Glover and Sarah Holson, have spent the last couple of years doing what they characterize, I think, fairly as the first systematic evaluation of the impact of freedom of information in the world. They've spent a few years interviewing government officials, surveying requesters, studying newspaper coverage of the law, and analyzing the official literature. And they've been trying to reach some major findings about the way in which the law has worked. And I just want to highlight four things that they have flagged. The first is that some findings about the users of the law. They make the point, as you probably are not surprised to learn, that even though FOI laws are often pitched as tools for ordinary citizens to use, in fact, the vast majority of UK citizens do not use the law. Less than 0.2% of UK citizens are estimated ever to have made a request under the UK law. And they make the observation that in a way, it's fortunate that this is the case, because the system only works because the vast majority of individuals don't use it. If they did use it, the system would break down from overload. They make the point, not surprising perhaps, that it is advantaged sectors, journalists, interest groups, businesses, sometimes legislators who are using the law. Although I should note that this is largely an impressionistic finding based on interviews and reviews of documents and so forth. We don't have in this study a good breakdown, statistical breakdown of the actual flow of requests by category of requesters, and I'll come back to that in a moment. The second big point is that FOI in Britain has developed a complex internal plumbing. Now, what do I mean by that? I mean that there's a more complicated, more institutionalized, and more centralized apparatus for processing requests than proponents and bureaucrats initially expected the law would have. There were some observers, I won't mention names, who suggested that parliamentary systems like the UK were likely to develop a fairly centralized way of thinking about handling FOI requests, but we were assured in 2004 that this would not be the case. But in fact, that sort of a apparatus has apparently emerged. Each department, you will not be surprised to learn, has an FOI unit responsible for dealing with FOI requests. But the government has also developed central coordinating mechanisms, including a clearinghouse in the Ministry of Justice, responsible for dealing with complicated or sensitive requests. There's another coordinating unit for national security cases, and there's another body within the Cabinet Office for requests that pertain to the operation of Cabinet or that interest Cabinet or are of particular interest to the Prime Minister. And a point I would make is that this is an internal architecture not described in the law, not required by the law, but which I am fairly sure affects the treatment of a certain subset of requests in the UK system. I should note, too, that Jeremy Hayes, the journalist I cited earlier on, also makes the observation that there is evidence that departments are developing, again, not surprisingly, mechanisms to assure that ministers and senior officials are not caught off guard by politically sensitive releases of information. So that's the second big observation about the emergence of this internal architecture. The third, and I think from the point of view of the Constitution Unit, the most important finding, has to do with outcomes. That is essentially what behavioral changes, what substantive good or harm was done by the adoption of this law. And I think their overall argument is that the effect of the law is muted, both in terms of benefits that were anticipated and harms that were anticipated. They make the observation that the law has increased transparency, both by requests and also by encouraging proactive disclosure, although it falls far short of a substantial change in bureaucratic culture within government. They say there's modest evidence that the law has increased accountability, although they make the observation, again, I think sensibly, that the law has its greatest effect when the disclosure falls on favorable ground, when there are other circumstances that would tend to encourage the use of the information. Existing parliamentary interest, internal party fissures that would tend to cause individuals to have an interest to use information, the nearness of an election, pre-existing public interest in the topic, and so on. They do make the observation about some observations about benefits that have not been realized. They suggest that the law has not significantly improved public understanding of government decisions, has not improved political participation, and this goes back to the story I told you at the start, has not improved trust in government. For me, one of the intriguing findings here, though, is about what the Constitution Unit study finds about all of the harms that were apprehended by government officials before the law was adopted. The study finds that the law hasn't undermined conventions about civil service as servant neutrality, hasn't significantly weakened practices regarding civil servant anonymity, hasn't undermined assumptions or conventions about ministerial responsibility or about collective responsibility of cabinet. It hasn't discouraged proper record keeping or encouraged more casual decision making. And it hasn't discouraged the inflow of information from third parties. And so that is good news, I think. It shows that the naysayers who were suggesting that the constitutional order was threatened by the adoption of freedom of information law have overestimated their fears. Then a fourth point about the Constitution Unit study, essentially some observations from them about where we are today, and they suggest that we are in sort of a stasis, a period of unpleasant equilibrium, I suppose. They suggest there's no going back, no danger that the law will be completely overhauled. But I think, if I'm reading them correctly, also suggesting that there's no clear going forward. We're in this kind of awkward middle ground. The phrase that's used by the Constitution Unit and has been used by others is that we are in a period of legal trench warfare over individual cases. And I think actually this metaphor is completely apt. It's like the Allies versus the Axis powers in the First World War. It really depends on where the trenches were established in 1914. You've got both sides hoping for a big breakout, and which never really happens. But you get a lot of really unpleasant trench warfare in the meantime. There, in terms of big breakouts, there have been attempts by the government in several instances, and I won't go through all of them, to amend the law in unfavorable ways. But in general, all of these attempts to restrict the law have been defeated because of public or interest group backlash. So that's a good news. But I do tend to agree with this notion that we're in a period of legal trench warfare. And one of the points I'll come back to in a moment is the way in which, from my point of view, and it's hard to figure out how to articulate this, the substantive point of the law, timely and fair access to information, has, at least in my experience, been displaced by a preoccupation with proper interpretation of the law. And I know these are related points, but we need to interpret the law properly. But a dialogue about the proper interpretation of precedents of statutory language can go on interminably and defeat the point of timely and fair access to information. And I find in my cases that tends to be where we are. I mentioned the story of me being the only actor with a substantive interest left in the dispute among lawyers about the interpretation of the law in a sort of FOI version of Jarndyce v. Jarndyce, a legal case that goes on interminably. And that sort of leads into, I'll give you a few more stories about what I've been up to. The case I mentioned at the start is not principally a story about using FOI to get information about FOI, but these cases I'm about to tell you are. They're basically reprises of requests I've made in other jurisdictions. And I have to say that I have not once asked the British government department to release information that was not already released to me in another Commonwealth jurisdiction. It wasn't like I was going in and throwing them curveballs. But you know, my experience, as you'll see, has not been entirely favorable. But the general point I would make is that if you want to make a really thorough and robust evaluation of the law, you need to get data about who is using the law, what kind of people are using it, what kind of information they're looking for, and how those requests are being treated. And a substantial amount of that data is actually held by the departments that are receiving the requests, very often in their case management systems. And so one of the things I try to do is to use FOI to get that data so I can understand how the law is working. I've also made requests with an effort to learn about how internal clearance and coordination processes are working. Let me give you a glimmer of what could be done in this way. Earlier this year, in April, I put a research note on my website that was looking at the treatment of 16,000 requests received by the Ministry of Defense in the first 4 years of the law. The Ministry of Defense in central government is the agency that gets the most requests. So I obtained from MOD, through FOI, processing data extracted from their case management systems about the handling of 16,000 requests. And then once you have that data, you can start to break things down a bit. For example, the timeline for initial responses in 2007-2008 was in general about 25 days. That is, it took 25 days on average for the department to respond to a request. But for self-identified journalists, it was 32 days. And for self-identified MPs, it was 40 days. The response exceeded the due date set by the department in general about 15% of the time overall. But it was 22% of the time for journalists and 46% of the time for members of parliament. I can also tell you something about the overall trend in requests in MOD. If you look at a chart for the volume of requests received month by month in the Ministry of Defense over the first 4 years, you'll see sort of a steady, it's sort of like a curve, a drop in 2005 and then a kind of more steady decline over time in the succeeding years. The drop at the start is sort of understandable. You know, people got excited about the law in the first year and then enthusiasm waned. But the interesting thing is that the decline is going on over time. But when you take the processing data, you can decompose that and see what's going on. And an interesting and maybe worrisome trend, you'd have to do further research on it, is that requests, say from academics, are relatively stable. They fluctuate. It's very interesting, actually. You can see them fluctuating according to the academic year. You get a good sense of when professors work and when they don't. And requests from businesses, although volatile, are relatively stable over time. It's requests from self-identified private individuals that are declining sharply over time. Now, let me emphasize, we don't want to read too much into that data, but that might imply, if we were going to pursue that line of thinking, a system that is now seeing private individuals retreat for one reason or another from FOI to a system that's more dominated by these established interests. But again, I don't want to read too much into that data. I just want to suggest what you can start to do when you have the data. I can also tell you something about referrals to the Cabinet Office. I mentioned that the clearance process in the UK there's a certain trigger list issued by the Ministry of Justice. If a request hits one of those triggers, it goes to the clearinghouse in the Ministry of Justice. Some of those requests go over the Cabinet Office for a combination of reasons, including whether it's of particular interest to the PM or Cabinet. I've been trying to see what the flow looks like. I learned just a couple of weeks ago that about 600 cases have been referred to the Cabinet Office over the first 4 years of the law. They're principally cases, or disproportionately, I should say, cases from the Foreign Office and Ministry of Defense. Those are the ones that tend to go up and over. And it's interesting to see how that is evolving over time. The Ministry of Justice will tell you the number of cases that are flowing through the clearance process are declining over time, but that is not the case for requests from the Foreign Office and the Ministry of Defense. So it would be interesting to see how that's evolving over time. So there's two little snapshots for you, and you might think, well, Al, you know, you've been unduly cynical about the operation of the law. You're getting your data. But I'll tell you something. I started looking for that data from the Ministry of Defense in 2005. It was the subject of a tribunal decision. I got the data in spring of 2009. So that's almost 4 years of slogging. When I asked the Cabinet Office for data, basic information about the cases that were being reviewed by them Their initial response was to say that the release of information pertaining to the operation of the Freedom of Information Act would be prejudicial to the effective operation of the Freedom of Information Act. They invoked Section 36, and we were off the Information Commissioner, which ruled against the Cabinet Office in October 2007, 2 years later, over 2 years later. I then made a second request looking for updated information, and the Cabinet Office invoked the cost limit provision of the Freedom of Information Act without ever talking to me about ways in which we could simplify the request. Back it went to the Information Commissioner, which issued a second ruling in May 2009 that the Cabinet Office had breached its duty to advise and assist me as a requester. We then continued with 4 months of informal consultation over the release of the information, and I released that tiny little bit of, I received that tiny little bit of data just 2 weeks ago. And grim though that those stories are, those are my success stories. I mentioned that the process, the clearance process, involves requests coming into government departments that may or may not hit so-called triggers. If they hit a trigger, they go to the clearinghouse in the Ministry of Justice. Then some of them may go to the Cabinet Office. I've just discovered how many went to the Cabinet Office, but I'm still trying to get information about which ones have gone to the clearinghouse. I began that adventure in early 2005. My last request for information about cases being referred to the clearinghouse was filed on October 19th, 2005. It was refused on Section 36 grounds, prejudicial to public affairs. The internal review on that decision took 107 business days. The internal review concluded, to our shock, that the initial decision was correctly reasoned. So it went off to the Information Commissioner in early 2006 to determine whether the Ministry of Justice, the body responsible for implementation of the Freedom of Information Act, had appropriately applied the prejudice to public affairs exemption. And I know now you are on the edge of your seat wondering what happened in that investigation. And sadly, I cannot tell you. The case remains unresolved after almost 4 years of passage after the initial request. It's still sitting on the commissioner's desk. Let me tell you another story. One of the other ways in which I try to explore the operation of the law is by asking for processing files for requests. That is, if I filed an FOI request, I will ask later for the processing file. Show me the file that showed how you decided how to deal with the request. It's useful in finding out how the plumbing works, who was consulted, where did the request track, and so on. And again, this is not novel. I've done this in other jurisdictions as well. I made a processing file request to the Cabinet Office in December 2005, and it was denied. You probably already know what section of the Act is invoked in this particular case. The rationale was that my intention had been to circumvent the powerful enforcement mechanism provided by the law, and there was no public interest in disclosure. Now let me just, by way of background, tell you something. That the Lord Chancellor in the UK gave a speech earlier this year in which he said that the point of the law was to overturn a paternalistic, we-know-best attitude in Whitehall. Well, let's go back and look at the reasoning of this decision. There's a statement here about intent. My intent was to circumvent the powerful enforcement mechanism provided by the law. And they also had to reach a conclusion about whether there was any public interest in disclosure, and they reached the conclusion that there was not. But did they ask me what my intent was? And did they ask me what my purpose was in seeking this information? And the answer is no on both points. And you're probably wondering, well, gee, what happened when that went to the Information Commissioner's office? And the answer is, I can't tell you. It's not yet resolved by the Information Commissioner, even though the dispute is now coming up on 4 years of age. But I can tell you two things. The Information Commissioner hasn't bothered to ask me what the purpose of my request was either. And I can make an observation, I think, about the powerful enforcement mechanism provided by the Freedom of Information Act. I have doubts about its power, and I am pretty clear that I am not the guy who's circumventing it. So that's basically my story. I have another tale of woe about a processing file request to the Ministry of Defense as well, which is also in suspense at the Information Commissioner's office. And you know, you may think, well, Al, you're a nuisance, and your view would be broadly shared in the United Kingdom at the moment. But you know, just to back up, the very first Freedom of Information request I ever made over 20 years ago came about because my wife was having difficulties getting a visa. We were in Canada at the time. She's a U.S. citizen. She needed a visa to enter the country. The Canadian Ministry of Foreign Affairs took 2 years to figure out what to do with it, and eventually sent us a letter telling us that, you know, because we had failed to maintain communication with the department, they were rejecting the application. Mm-hmm. And we had been constantly trying to get their attention. So I made a request for a copy of the processing file for that visa application, which I got, which revealed that, in fact, they had copies of all of the correspondence that we had been sending them over those 2 years. Now, that was a processing file request. And I don't think anyone would dispute that that was an abuse of the law. But that, in fact, from my point of view, is one of the very points of the law, to induce that kind of accountability. So the question would be, why does the Freedom of Information community in the UK think that requests or exercises of rights under the law which they shepherd should be treated differently than requests for information about the application of any other law in the British system? And that's one of the points I think we will have out at some certain point. Let me just tell you in sum where I am on FOI in the UK. As you may have gleaned, I am personally exhausted and frustrated by it. I don't have an organization behind me. I don't have staff behind me. I'm doing all this myself. And I'll tell you something. It's incredibly difficult to maintain constancy of thought about a request. You know, you've got a communication from a government official saying, we have a question for you about your request, which we last dealt with 3 years ago, and you're constantly going through these dusty files and ransacking your equally dusty memory to remember what the state of play was in the issue. So I'm frustrated. But I do think that if we disaggregate those overall numbers, you know, we will find that there are components or streams within UK FOI that are functional, that work, that maybe even meet the expectations of the law. But I suspect there are also some, perhaps small, but significant other flows that are highly dysfunctional. And I would be curious to learn more about what the differences are there. I'm, after 4 years, surprised and disappointed by the failure of officials to adopt common sense measures that would save money and make the law work better, the failure to acknowledge communications, the failure to engage in conversation before making rulings under the law, the failure to check assumptions about motives and purposes, the failure to apologize when service standards are not met. These have all been very disappointing. And I am also disheartened personally by the extent to which the aims of the law have been displaced by wrangling over the meaning of the law. The extent, to put it another way, which way the law has become a game for lawyers. And finally, I'm frustrated by the inability or unwillingness of the Commissioner's office to render decisions in a timely way, because I think this is not an experience peculiar to the UK, any law is only as good as its enforcement mechanism. If government agencies begin to realize that they can game the law by simply giving a negative decision and punting it to the Information Commissioner or a similar body, they will begin to do that. And in this respect, I should say that Maurice Frankel of the Campaign for Freedom of Information has made essentially the same point. He's made the point that the average processing time for complaints going to the Information Commissioners is now about 2 years. But even in that, there is significant variation. There's about 25% of cases that are resolved in less than a year, but there's about 30% of cases that drag on for more than 2 years, which is too long. but as Morris says, giving a negative decision and punting it over to the information commissioner is essentially like getting a two-year exemption under the law. So with those cheerful notes, let me then stop and we can perhaps open it up to conversation.
Yes, I'll exercise the moderator's prerogative in asking the first question, which is, would you say that on balance the recent scandal over the Member of Parliament expense records has been, which you might want to describe a bit so everyone knows about it, which has holds the potential for being a positive influence on freedom of information implementation in the UK, at least in the long run?
The scandal, and there are others in the room who can fill in the details that I may miss, this is a story that begins basically with an individual, or several individuals, but including one individual, an American, Heather Brook, who made a request for details about the expense claims being made by members of Parliament. And that that request for those details was resisted vigorously, went all the way through the process, and eventually resulted in a decision in favor of disclosure earlier this year. The parliamentary officers were in the process of cleaning up the data for release when the raw information about the expense details was leaked to the media, causing a really boggling furor about the way in which MPs had been abusing their expenses, producing ministerial resignations and pledges not to run in the next campaign, and really rattling all political parties and also, of course, the government. The immediate consequence of that, of course, is to assure that FOI is locked in for the long run, because the public has seen how it can work in a very vivid and high-profile case. There had, in fact, been an earlier attempt to restrict the ambit of the law by taking Parliament out of it. You know, critical difference between U.S. and U.K. law. The U.K. law covers the legislative branch, the operational parts of the legislative branch. And I think we can feel fairly comfortable that that's not going to come back up on the agenda at any time soon.
I have to ask a companion question before, again, we throw it up to the audience. And as we've talked about the 79 so nations of the world that have transparency regimes, but on the CGS site, we also identify about three dozen nations under the category of nations poised to join the international transparency community. Would you say that on balance, the UK experience, which you know probably better than anyone else, as you've described, would be an encouragement or a discouragement to open government advocates and legislators in these 36 other nations considering taking that step? Is that something that would make them more likely to join the International Transparency Club, so to speak, or less likely, do you think?
Well, let me just back away from the one of the original proposition. I'm pretty sure there are a lot of other people who know more about the operation of UK law than I do. I've given you sort of a one person's experience, and you know, in the interest of disclosure, I think, you know, one of the ways in which we reconcile the big story I was telling you with my personal story is that one of those enclaves where FOI is not trenching very effectively, ironically, is the operation of FOI itself. And that just happens to be the particular part of the front line that I am engaged in battle on.
Transparency about transparency, so to speak.
Yeah, life is rich in ironies. So so that's the caveat, and you've heard a disproportionate amount about that particular experience today. I'm not sure the British experience would be heartening for a policymaker or a government leader who's thinking about transparency, because, you know, I'm not sure Gordon Brown has been having a good year because of FOI. But you know, let's step back for a moment. It is unambiguously true that British citizens know more about the operation of their government, about the formulation and execution of policy, than they did 10 years ago. They know more about their history than they did 10 years ago. And they know more about regulation of private or public affairs and so on. So they are unambiguously better off. Now, does the law work smoothly? No. Has the law fallen short of the very high expectations that some actors have? Yes, it has. But, you know, I think candidly, if we were looking, for example, FOI experience in other Commonwealth countries before 2005, we would not have been surprised by the evolution of policy in the UK. It hasn't revolutionized the constitutional order, but it has done good.
Well, how about questions from our audience here in Washington? We cannot take them from the people who are listening on the podcast, watching on the webcast quite yet, but I can assure you you'll have an opportunity at the 4th Annual International Rights Foundation to raise those questions. Yes, sir, you over on that side.
Al, I was curious, how do you explain the dysfunctionality of the Information Commissioner's office and process? Is it personality? Is it resources? Is it ambit? Is it because of what they saw their mission being? I mean, did they see themselves as one of those coordinating committees, in effect, that would slow down and diminish the PR impact on the rest of government? Did they see themselves the way Kevin Dunyan sees himself in Scotland as the public's advocate? I mean, is it a vision? Is it process? What's your explanation?
That's a great question. Incidentally, you and I were both at a conference in 2007 in the International Conference of Information Commissioners held in New Zealand in 2007.
I missed New Zealand. Kristen was there, though.
Oh, pardon me. In which I gave a speech in it, which, among other things, I was critical about delays in processing requests, complaints in the Information Commissioner's office. The Information Commissioner in the UK did not respond well to that speech.
That still does not respond.
But the cases I just told you about are the cases I was complaining about in 2007.
Did that speech have an adverse effect on the handling of those cases, I wonder?
I can't approve.
If you make a FOIA request about that, you might want
to.
Well, until I get hit by Section 36, prejudice to public affairs. But the question, I think, is central to the implementation of digestion phase, not just in the UK, but all over the world, because one of the critical questions, especially for those countries that have got laws that have information commission model in it, is how well does the commissioner work? Because there have been many stories from other jurisdictions in which the aims of the law have been thwarted because the commission of the enforcement model breaks down. And so this is a critically important question. And I don't know, because I haven't studied it closely, the difficult, precisely what's going on in the UK case. I think, in fairness, they were hit with more requests in the first year than more complaints, I should say, than they expected. There's an important difference just in terms of workload between the Scottish commissioner and the UK commissioner. And so there may be a resourcing question. There may have been a resourcing question in 2005. There may continue to be a resourcing question there as well. I do think that there is, though, to some degree, some confusion about work methods and ambitions. I was having an interaction with the commissioner's office in August about these processing file requests, and I made the observation that they had never asked me about my ambitions, purposes in filing these requests, and never asked me for a representation on Section 36. And they made the point that we're not arbitrators. We're determining whether the department has properly applied the law. Now, we can take that on its own merits. And if the question has to be resolved in order to apply the law is whether my purpose was reasonable, you sort of have to ask me about it. That's a question of fact that my input's relevant to. But there's actually an interesting confusion there. If you look at the Constitution Unit study, there is a description based on Information Commission data of how they're resolving cases, and the breakdown is includes a proportion of cases that were arbitrated or mediated. So clearly, somebody at some point thought they were doing arbitration or mediation. I know in another case, there was an abortive attempt to do mediation in which the investigator said, okay, you know, you want to talk with the department and see if you can work something out. And we began the conversation, and then it just sort of fell through. That was, I think, over a year ago. So I think they're trying to figure out, in part, what their role is. But I think if we look at other countries, you know, for example, India is another great case. My hunch would be that the success of that law is going to hinge critically on the capacity of information commissioners in the Indian case to handle the inflow of complaints there. And we already see evidence that the purposes of the law might be confounded because of the inability of commissioners to dispose in a timely way with the stock, the accumulating pile of complaints.
Hi, thanks very much for your remarks. It's very interesting. Before we move on, can you give us an idea, do you know about how many countries have an information commissioner model?
That's a good question, and I don't know the answer offhand, but I think that there is a study, I saw it on a table around here, by Richard Cameron and Laura Newman.
The Carter Center.
Did I see copies of that flying on
the table? Yeah.
The Carter Center in Atlanta, yes.
Yeah.
Which might have the answer.
Yeah. Although it's a few years old now, which in this world is like, you know, not up to date. But moving on, I mean, this question of implementation for new laws, I mean, everybody says an important element is the so-called political will, which it seems to me has a few different components. One would be when this law went into effect, was there a big deal made about it and clear direction given that, you know, disclosure is the rule, non-disclosure is the exception. And a related component would be, was there a lot of initial training for officials who are going to be carrying out the law? And has there also then been ongoing trainings and opportunities like, you know, we see here through the Access
American Society of Access Professionals.
Right, where they have at least biannual meetings, everybody gets together, you get updated, there's a, you know, you build up kind of a core of people who care about and are interested in this topic.
Yeah, I would have to say that the British government took implementation and training very seriously. I mean, they delayed the implementation of the law for 5 years.
Right.
They invested a substantial amount of money, millions of pounds, into training and preparation and development of systems and training of officials before they put the law online. You know, we've got instances of other jurisdictions less well-heeled that adopt a law and put it into force a few months later. That's what I believe Jamaica did.
Argentina.
And so, you know, the UK had the luxury of time and resources, and there was a cadre of civil servants who took the proper implementation of the law very seriously. So, I think in terms of implementation, it's really the best case scenario.
So, but it doesn't seem to make a difference in terms of the result then, or is that?
Well, I think, you know, the. I think, in fairness, if you had a representative of the British government who's working in this area, sitting in the room here, he would say, you've heard an awful lot of carping about a very small pool of requests. Mine. And he would go back to the aggregate data, he or she would go back to the aggregate data that I presented at the top and said, look, 140,000 requests presented to central government. And the preponderance of them resulting in full disclosure and dealt with within the statutory time limit of 20 days. You know, that's pretty good. And I would concede that's good. And that the key point I would then make is let's get into the bowels of the system and start disaggregating those aggregate results and figure out where it, and it's just like in the U.S. system. What's the department that has the bulk of the U.S. requests?
Depends on how you count. The Veterans Administration and Social Security have millions.
So there are multiple systems, right? Some which are problematic and some which are non-problematic, and I think we'd want to start doing the sorting in the UK case as well.
Speaking of the U.S., and speaking of information commissioners and your experience there, would you say that your experience would be supportive of the idea of having an information commissioner in the United States or not?
Yeah, I would. A properly structured information commissioner's office is, in my view, the best way to do enforcement, notwithstanding the silly story I just told you. You know, I could tell you a story about my U.S. requests. I just had a letter from the Department of Homeland Security asking, no, pardon me, the Department of National Defense asking whether I was still cared about a response to a request that I filed in 2003 relating to some NATO documents. So, and you know, and even though I moan about the British Information Commissioner, following up on that request in the U.S. system would be an even tougher call for me, someone in my position. So, and I have to say, you know, in a way, life can be a lot simpler with some easy steps. I'm confounded, for example, by I file an information request, and I get a response back 20 days later that says, you know, you've hit the cost limit, we're not going to respond. And I think to myself, we all know where this is going to go. Why didn't you pick up the phone? I mean, the research question, pardon me for putting it this hyperbolically, but the research question for me is, does anyone in Whitehall own a telephone? Pick up the phone and talk to the requester. Sort it out. The purpose of the law is not to have a perfect interpretation of the letter of the law. The purpose of the law is to set a framework for conversation about timely and fair access to information. So pick up the phone. Similarly, when it gets to the investigative stage, if it looks like there's a middle ground or a way of sorting out a problem, don't push it all the way through to a decision notice. Just tell people to pick up the phone and sort it out. You know, in this case regarding the Ministry of Defense, which I was looking for processing data, it went to the tribunal. So when it gets to the tribunal stage, you begin to see the internal records pertaining to the investigation. And it transpired that halfway through the investigation, but 2 years into the complaint, the Ministry of Defense had acquired the capacity to give me much of the data I asked for at much lower cost. They didn't have it when I filed the request, but they did have it by the time the investigation was in midstream. So, you know, I sort of think to myself, well, at some point, someone should just pick up the phone and say, okay, give him the data he asked for, or at least talk to him about working something out. But they didn't do that. Why? Because the purpose of the investigation is to determine whether the law was properly applied at the moment the initial denial was made, which is perfection of law, but an undermining of the point of the law. So.
We have at least three more questions, and we will take time to cover them to be sure. I want to first take a question apropos of what you just said about negotiating with requesters or mediating. I take a question from the new director of the Office of Government Information Services at the National Archives and Records Administration, Mary Nisbet, who's going to be focusing on exactly what you talked about. So let's take her question first.
Thank you. Thank you, Dan. In fact, I wanted to follow up with the observation about an information commissioner properly structured could help the process and the work. And I would love to hear what you would consider to be properly structured. I heard your easy steps and couldn't agree more. I think that's particularly something that the government agencies are trying to strive for now, to have better customer service and do some easy things like that. But speaking from the information commissioner office or position, what do you think would work?
Oh, that's a large question.
It is, and maybe we don't have time to go into it now, but just, you know, your quick answer to what a proper structure of such an office would be.
It's a big part of what we strive to do here, to the extent possible, in celebrating International Right to Know Day, to take a comparative law approach to see what lessons can be learned from one system and applied to another. And in the past, traditionally, it's always been the U.S. being the teacher and other nations of the world learning our lessons from our mistakes in some respects. But now we're at a point at which it's reversed, and we can learn perhaps from the experience elsewhere.
I will tell you, you know, I've filed a lot of requests under Canadian law, and until recently, my experience with the investigators in the Information Commissioner's office was really congenial, and I've begun to appreciate, and this may just be an advantage of the Canadian Information Commissioner has been in operation now for 1982, so we're coming up on 30 years. Is that right?
Close.
Yeah. It may just be a matter of experience. There is a difference in mandate. The Canadian Commissioner does not have order power. But one thing I have appreciated, and even more in retrospect, is that there is the commissioners, the investigators I dealt with were firm, they were fair, they were not advocates on one side of the law, but they were sensible in their approach to the law. They could go into a department and say, come on. This is overkill. Work something out here. You've pushed it too far, and you could work. And it didn't always work, but sometimes it worked. And they would talk with you. They would say, okay, here's what the ball game is. Here's what the state of play is, and a certain degree of, ironically, transparency about the investigative process, I think, helps. Because, we all want to know basically what's going on. Mm-hmm. What's the deal? And I think just these are sort of common sense points. Tell people what's going on with their file. Mm-hmm. Treat them courteously. Try to work out something where you can. Now, it may just be that the Canadians have the advantage of experience, that they can kind of go in and they're more confident in knowing what the ambit of the law is, what will stick and what won't. That it may just be that.
It sounds like, in that experience, they do give you, quote-unquote, transparency about transparency, mm-hmm. which is to say about the process, and that can go a long, long way toward dealing with public concerns, at least at that overlay level. We have questions here and there and over there as well. This gentleman right here was first.
I have a question. I mean, your comments were about requests and complaints, but there's another side, the proactive transparency or disclosure scheme, as it's called in the UK, Information Act. I wonder if your research or the UCL research has looked at the disclosure schemes and how it works.
They did. I haven't. They did. And my recollection of the top line on that point is that their assessment is not entirely favorable. The proactive disclosure schemes, the publication schemes, as they call them, did not work as well as they had anticipated. But I can't go into detail, but it's in the survey.
Yes, ma'am,
back
there.
I was wondering, as part of the Freedom of Information Act in the UK, there
you can speak as loud as you can, just the basic audience mic is over at this side.
Is it part of the mandate of the public officials and of the commissioners to disseminate information, raise awareness, so the common citizens are able to use it more, and it makes it more citizen-friendly? And what is the role of the civil society, non-profit organizations, to help build this partnership between government officials and common citizens, so the mass has really access to the Freedom of Information Act?
I think, whether formally or informally, I think the argument would be that the commissioner and government departments do have a mandate or an obligation to disseminate information about how the law should work. And I think the argument would be made with justification that most departments have made a very strong effort to put the FOI function forward so that people can see how requests should be made. So for, one very telling question is, when you get to the home of the government department, can you see where the FOI link is? Other jurisdictions aren't always very good about doing that. The UK has been. So in that sense, I think they've been very forward. And I think, among other things, it has to be said that they have, at least in the early phases, were doing tracking polls to see what public awareness of the law was. So they were attending to this. The second question is about, I think, civil society role in this.
And Morris Frankel is just a giant in that area.
Well, Morris Frankel and the Campaign for Freedom of Information has just done extraordinary work over a very long period of time in terms of building awareness about the importance of the law and the way in which the law can improve the quality of policy deliberations. And I think also, I mean, civil society has a very important function in helping citizens figure out how to use the law. You know, I don't retain legal counsel to deal with my requests for the very practical reason that I can't afford to do it. But I also don't do it because I want to see what the system feels like to an individual who's doing it alone. And, you know, going it alone, I'm a professor of law. But I'll tell you, as a professor of law, going it alone in the, at the higher levels of the process is very, very tough. I mean, I've been told, frankly, I wasn't told in conversation, I was told in print that I didn't understand the purposes of the UK Freedom of Information Act. I'm constantly sort of getting these signals that I'm not observing proper legal form. But that goes to my point. It's the displacement of the substantive aim of the law, this legal process.
Question here, sir.
I was thinking, can we entrust this responsibility of complaints against government departments with some already existing institution? For instance, like in Pakistan, what we have done is that the right to appeal lies with the institution of ombudsman. Now, ombudsman, even otherwise, he has been entrusted with the task of listening to the complaints against government departments. So a person from judicial background, he is in a better position. So if any department denies the information, the person can go to the office of the ombudsman. So instead of getting an information commissioner, isn't it better that if we go for already existing institutions and entrust them this responsibility?
I suppose this is a tactical question that I suppose depends on the circumstances of the particular country, right? And if you've got a nascent administrative capacity that you can expand to perform the function, I would see no reason not to do it if it has the resources and the skill set and the right disposition toward performing the function.
But that you mean to say an ombudsman function, which is what you're asking about the question? When you say the function, you mean the ombudsman function?
Well, I guess maybe
or the commissioner function? Because the two are slightly different, at least.
Well, I see. So the question is whether the enforcement capacity should go to an ombudsman without border power.
It's within the limit. So because we are going through the infancy stage, we have recently introduced these laws. And for the last 6-7 years, this system is working very well. Within the ombudsman's office, there is a cell which deals with that sort of complaints when citizens don't get the information that they require. So what we find in Pakistan, this system is working very well. Now in other countries, like in India, in UK, there is this information commissioner. So I was thinking that instead of going for an independent institution of information commissioner, isn't it better that if we entrust these responsibilities to already existing institutions which are very much familiar with the functioning of government departments, they have been receiving complaints against government departments even otherwise?
Well, here's where I get in trouble with some of my colleagues. For me, the material question would be what in the circumstances will work.
Okay.
So, and not knowing enough of particular circumstances, I can't render a judgment. But, you know, if hypothetically I were to be told there's one organization with adequate resources and a mandate that is appropriately structured and the skill set and so on, and it can do the job, then my inclination would be to say you should explore that possibility. If the alternative is to try and set up a new office that may not be adequately resourced, that may not be sufficiently entrenched in the political system in order to pull its weight. This is a question of fact contingent on the circumstances.
So if your nation has no commissioner, but that's not in the offing,
but if you do
have an ombudsman function.
Ombudsman has been there since 1983.
Right.
And because public servants are very much afraid of ombudsman because he has got so many powers and he can put them in dock. So when any department doesn't provide required information and the citizen goes to the office of the ombudsman, then public servants, they shiver. They literally shiver.
That's a perfect illustration. If you have no commissioner and you see advantages to that, notwithstanding some of the downsides that Professor Roberts has described in the UK, But if that's not really in the cards, so to speak, consider having an ombudsman, which coincidentally is exactly the direction which the United States had moved under the 2007 Floyd Amendments. And that's exactly the responsibility that Miriam Nisbet now has, as of about 3 weeks ago, since her ombudsman office has started up. So you two might want to talk during lunch.
The related question is, does your ombudsman / commissioner need to have order power?
Yes.
Or just advisory power?
No.
There's a doctrinal debate in the FOIP.
He has order power. Question. And anybody who wants to go against the orders of the ombudsman, he has to go into appeal to President of Pakistan. So I have been Director General of Ombudsman's Office. I have served there as Director General. And there was a lot of quick disposal there. And we have very quick disposal. Within few days' time, that complaint is resolved. So far it has been. There have been weaknesses in law in Pakistan because there are so many exemptions that it should not be against ideology of Pakistan, it should not be against Islam, it should not be against armed forces. And you see, there's so
you
many.
You thought that public interest exemption was pretty bad.
It's unfortunate you mentioned all of these possibilities because I now think I'm going to get versions of them the next time. Just under the prejudice of public affairs.
Well, on that very positive note, indeed, let's end this session. And please help me thank Professor Roberts. Presentation that truly got us off to an outstanding start this morning. And speaking of commissioners, I'll draw your attention to the fact that the next item on the agenda, after we take a quick break, is for us to connect with the ongoing International Conference of Information Commissioners that began last night, yesterday afternoon, our time, in Oslo, Norway. This is the sixth ICIC in short. And they have been, again, 6 hours ahead of us in Oslo. They have been proceeding with their first full day of proceedings this morning. And according to our estimation, they have just about finished their day's proceedings. They're about to go to a reception at City Hall in Oslo. But before that, we're going to try to our darndest to set up an audio link with two commissioners, the host commissioner, Arne Plitlett, the Norwegian Information Commissioner, who also is an ombudsman and has that tradition in Norway, and someone else who was mentioned earlier, Kevin Dunyan, who's the Information Commissioner from Scotland. So we're going to take a quick break here at this point, and in just a few minutes we'll come back, and hopefully we'll be hooked up just as we want to be with Oslo, Norway.